In 2004, blind American mountain climber Eric Wellenmayer traveled to Tibet in order to meet some children and teenagers who viewed him as their hero. These young people are also blind, and they had heard about Eric's successful ascent of Mount Everest 3 years before. They were very excited to meet him when he came to their school in Lhasa. They were used to being treated with significant contempt every time they went out on the streets of their city. They were safe and well cared for in their school, which had been founded and was still lovingly operated by a blind German woman. But their society still has some very traditional ideas about what causes blindness, and the main reaction seems to be to blame the blind people or their parents and to treat them like they're completely worthless human beings. And so for these students, to meet a blind person both famous and celebrated was not only an unexpected treat, but a potentially life-changing event. Eric, for his part, arrived for the visit with some high aspirations. He brought with him a number of experienced sighted climbers and dreamed of taking a few of the teens from this school on an expedition up Loch Garee, Stormy Mountain, at 23,000 feet, a summit higher than any peak in the world outside of the Himalayas. Hiking and climbing with his father and his brothers had brought emotional resilience, spiritual healing, and a sense of purpose to Eric's own teen years, and he wanted to pass on the gift of that experience by sharing it with these young Tibetans. Six kids from the school, along with Sabria Timberkin, the school's founding teacher, entered training with these American climbers, and ultimately they all set out on this trek. The undertaking proved to be transformative for all parties involved, bringing some important shifts in perspective to both the Americans and the Tibetans. The biggest learning for the Americans, goal-focused, risk-taking, high achievers all, was that there might actually be something more important than getting to the summit. If you just march a blind person along at the greatest speed possible, explained Sabria, there's no joy in it. Remember, she speaks from experience. She herself is blind. And she has surrounded herself with these blind children who look to her for guidance and inspiration. She said, a blind person needs time to smell the aromas of the high places, to hear the sound of the wind and the yak bells, to touch the surface of the rock and the ice formations along the way. These are the things, along with a sense of accomplishment, that can make climbing a rich experience for someone who cannot see. Sabria values teamwork and mutual supportiveness, and she feels it's of the utmost importance not to leave anyone behind. The Americans also value teamwork, but their idea was that if even one person could reach the summit, the whole team would have succeeded. Their habit was to make decisions based on what would support the achievement of that goal, and so it made perfect sense to them to send some of the team members back so that others could go on. The teens, for their part, were striving to be a success in the eyes of others. They were accomplishing things that they had barely been able to dream of, and they relied on the adults to guide them and make some of these crucial decisions about whether to press on or go back. The high altitude extreme conditions, combined with the clash of perspectives, made for some tense moments. Ultimately, everyone came back safely, having gained new insights and become stronger from the experience. In the end, said Eric, whose original dream this had been, in the end, the climb turned out to be more about friendship than about getting to the highest point on the mountain. A shift in perspective can be quite revelatory. The prophet Isaiah must have known this when he called for his people to arise, lift their eyes, and look around. These were people who had been lying in the dust of despair for a long time. having been conquered by their enemies, seen their cities and their sacred places destroyed, and having been taken captive into exile. They knew themselves to be people without a land or a leader or a place of worship. They're scattered and humiliated. Things could hardly get any worse. And then along comes this prophet. Get up, he says. Look around. Something new is happening. It's time to shine. What a startling announcement. And we can read it in Isaiah chapter 60, verses 1 through 6. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and God's glory will appear over you. Nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Lift up your eyes and look around. They all gather together. They come to you. Your sons shall come from far away, and your daughters shall be carried on their nurses' arms. You shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and rejoice. Because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you. The young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord. This is a vision of reversal of circumstances, which must have taken extraordinary faith to articulate. Look, says Isaiah, to people immersed in poverty and shame. God has not forgotten you. God's light is shining on you, even now. God's gathering together all of your loved ones and bringing them home. Those who have wandered far are coming back with abundant blessings to contribute. God's light manifest in your community is so bright that people from many lands and histories and cultures will be drawn to its brightness. Your anguish will turn to rejoicing. Your faces will be radiant. Your hearts will be full and happy. All those who arrive will come together praising God. Wow. To a people whose lives and spirits had been crushed, Isaiah might have sounded like he was living in fantasy land. But just like the rare and remarkable person who, for example, has a vision of how blind people can be active and valuable members of society, is able, by his or her words and deeds, to begin to actually make it so, Isaiah's willingness to speak of a new and different reality has the potential to be, in fact, the start of the new thing that God is doing. Dating from 500 or 600 years before the birth of Jesus, Isaiah is inviting his listeners to rise from whatever rubble might seem to define our condition and look at our situation in the light of God's grace and mercy. Isaiah's words plant a seed, a good seed that is destined to thrive and to grow. Isaiah reminds us that God is a gatherer and a healer, a restorer of life, a giver of good gifts. The writer of the Gospel of Matthew certainly was familiar, some 600 or 700 years later, very familiar with Isaiah's convictions. As Matthew reached for words to convey the significance of Jesus' birth, he drew on Isaiah's understanding of how God's presence, visualized as glorious light, illumines our stumbling confusion and our chaos, and draws us into renewed and revitalized human community, rich in resources that protect and support life. Matthew, echoing Isaiah, described travelers from afar, bringing gifts of gold and frankincense. He wrote of radiant starlight and the overwhelming joy that fills human hearts when our spiritual quest is fulfilled and we find ourselves in the presence of God's incarnate love. He described profound moments of worship and praise. And you can read all of this in chapter 2 of Matthew's gospel. And one of the things Matthew may have been trying to point us to is the realization that God's work of gathering us together, bringing light to disperse our gloom, and putting all of our gifts and energies into good use is a work that never stops. God's glory, said Matthew, is made known in the Christ child, a new but consistent with the past manifestation of God's desire to heal, to restore, to unite around the high purposes of expressing gratitude and service and praise. What the prophet and the gospel writer have both said continues to be true. God is gathering us together by dawning upon us and shining in our midst. Everybody who's ever seen or created or set up a manger scene knows this. Both the shepherds and the kings are kneeling before the baby, which is to say, people of low estate and high estate, people from near and from far, people from field and farm, alongside people from the academy and the observatory. People so familiar that we hardly notice them, joined by people who are spectacularly exotic and fascinating. All of humanity can be found in the spectrum between the wealthy magi and the simple guardians of the sheep. John Shea, in a book called Starlight, describes a creche scene that he likes to pay a visit to every year at Christmas time. Apparently this thing gets set up and then anybody can come and look at it. And he likes it because of the multitude and the diversity of the figurines set up and crowded into the stable in this particular manger scene. And over the years he's noticed A Vietnamese refugee is there, a farm worker is there, two young lovers are there, carolers are there, a man in a nightshirt carrying a lantern is there, Buddha, Krishna. So many representations of so many walks of life are there gathered at the manger. And I guess the custom is that any visitor who comes is welcome to bring a figurine and add it to the scene, and none is ever rejected or sent away. In my observation, it's actually not only all of humanity that gathers at the manger, but in fact all of creation. Not so long ago, I had the opportunity to gaze at a painting which covered the entire wall of a restaurant, an obscure little restaurant off the central plaza of an obscure little town in Brazil called Mariana. I filled my plate at the buffet counter one day at lunchtime and sat down to enjoy a remarkable view. In the painting, Bethlehem had somehow become a coastal village, and the stable was right at the shore. Fish and octopi and whales and dolphins and all kinds of sea creatures were streaming toward the light in the manger, splashing in and out of the water, while animals and people walked along the sand in the same direction. Santa Claus was in the picture. And the three kings, now pay attention, the three kings were riding seahorses. It was a wonderfully delightful depiction of what Matthew called overwhelming joy and Isaiah's assurance that you shall see and be radiant, your heart shall thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you. Truly, even today, the light of God's works draw us together in worship, and God makes clear that all kinds of gifts, all kinds of people and creatures are welcome. And so now we come to the point of having to make a little confession. Such a grand and diverse jumble of people and creatures coming together to celebrate the divine presence can be somewhat confusing and difficult for us to accept. Is there really no hierarchy, no measure of relative importance, no means of distinguishing who is more worthy? Is it really true that everyone who comes toward God's shining love with reverent and humble spirit is welcome with the same grace, the same forgiveness, and the same joy? Apparently so. And this can be a little bit shocking for those who have developed a lot of ideas about who's acceptable and who's unacceptable to God. The streaming multitudes come with a variety of life experiences, a variety of worldviews, a variety of limitations and abilities, a variety of perspectives and perceptions and ideas and understandings. God makes no effort to homogenize this rich variety into something uniform, bland, or boring. God seems happy to welcome all and to let us have the fun of figuring out how to relate to and learn from one another in the light of God's creative power. There is no doubt that we do have a lot to learn. Even as one, just as an example, just one international mountain climbing expedition full of challenging days and heated conversations exemplifies. This past fall, I had the opportunity to listen to a panel of religious leaders who had gathered from different faiths to try to talk to one another about the things that matter most to them. The rabbi drew laughs of recognition when she stood up and said, "Oh yes, we Jewish people know a lot about Muslims, and all of it is wrong." This could be said of each and every one of us. A lot of what we think we know is wrong. If our eyes are in reasonably good working order, we should not assume that we know what it is like to be a person with eyes that do not function. If we are Americans, we should not assume we know how a Tibetan thinks or feels. If we ourselves are Christian, we should not assume that we know what life is like for a Buddhist. When we have the joy of being brought together by the light of God with those who are different from us, we do well to remember that we only begin to understand the wide range of human perspectives as we dare to ask questions and to talk honestly and to listen deeply to one another. This is not to say that we need to hold back from becoming who God calls us to be. The message from Isaiah, remember, is get up and shine. Look up from ruin and devastation. Reflect the holy light that is coming your way. Be a people of hope and anticipation. It's simply an encouragement to also join in the adventure of learning about and rejoicing in the gifts and attributes that others bring to the gathering of those who would honor and glorify God. We can be our best and most faithful selves and make room for others all at the same time. Holy God, your bright richness is even now breaking into our present struggles and trials. Your light shines. Your glory rises even upon us. In this light, we see that you are with us. We see that you are working in our midst to heal and redeem. We see your great and active concern for restoration and for a gathering in of all that has been scattered. We bow in worship toward your love made visible in the form of the Christ child. We pray that our gifts and our willingness to shine forth some small part of your light might contribute to grace and peace and hope and security and justice for all. As Jesus taught us, we now join our voices together to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.